Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of You Have Shredded Me Radio. Today's show is called Time for a Plan. And during the show, we'll be discussing the You Have Shredded Me document, as well as the role of committees of safety and the militia in the plan to restore America. We'll finish up part two of going over the document. You can find it on www.youhavetreadonme.com. We'll be getting a more recent update on that one, so be looking for that as well. You can also, Gary, also everybody, we're trying something out now. If I could get you to if I could get everybody that's in the chat room to tell me if Gary's coming in okay. Gary, go ahead and start talking a little bit and see how you're coming through.
Okay, good evening, everybody. If you're able to hear me, we've made it. Defeated technology, and if not, we'll have to go back to the old stuff, seeing nothing come up.
So yeah, if you can hear Gary, just type back. If Gary's coming in okay, if you can hear him okay, type in something, let me know in the chat room. That would be greatly appreciated.
And then we can... anybody here except Randy? I know Randy can. No, I guess not, so I guess I'll have to call back on the other line.
All right, well, nobody's coming, nobody's answering yet, so call through and on the other line and we'll see what we have.
Well, why don't you ask them if you didn't hear Gary say no? I see an octopus, too.
Sorry about the delay here, people. We're trying something new, though. We have a problem with Gary coming in rather faint on the phone. So we're trying to finagle something here and see if we can't get them in better. And we've got buffering going on.
Well,
I've got 11, 12, 14 people in the chat room. I guess nobody else. I guess just go ahead and just call in.
Okay,
so we can
I'll
get the show. We can get the show on the road instead of having all this delay and technical issues. And then I will figure out. I'll just get Skype running. I'll figure out how to run with Skype, and I'll just bring you in on Skype from now on because you do sound a lot better through Skype.
Okay.
So, everybody, sorry about that. Gary Hunt is going to be calling back in now, so we'll get the show on the road. But as I was saying, tonight's show, we're going to be discussing the second part of the You Have Shredded Me document. This document, if you have not read it, it lays out a plan, an end goal objective of what we, the people, want. It covers all aspects from immigration to the military, commodity, or some form
Andy,
of commodity currency. Hey, Gary, how are you doing?
Pretty good. I can barely hear you now.
Now you can barely hear me?
Yeah. Well, technology is getting there. Can the people on the... chat hear me? If not, I can call back in, see if we can get a better connection.
Well, it seems like we're having a problem in the chat. People can't seem to get the show working for some reason. We're streaming, so... Well, for everybody who's not in our chat room listening in, sorry for the delays here. We were trying something out to get... so we could try to get Gary's volume up a little bit better so people would be able to hear him a little more. But we weren't able to get that done today, apparently, so we will continue on. Okay, it seems we're working again, so let's continue on. Like I said, we'll be covering the second part of the document. You can find the document at www.youhavetreadonme.com. Apparently, Gary's made a couple of additions to it, some improvements that needed to be made on it, so we'll be discussing those, and we'll get a link posted for that as well, and I'll tell everybody where that link is once we get it posted up. But more importantly, we're going to be discussing committees of safety and the role of the militia in all of this. Because those are going to be the foundations of everything. That was our foundation before. That will be our foundation again. You can find it at www.outpost-of-freedom.com/youhavetreadonme/index or just the you have tread on me part. So either way. All right, Gary. So, where do you want to start off with today? Do you want to finish going over the second part of the document where we left off at?
Yeah, I think it's important that everybody understand all of these elements and the significance of them. And we had gone through 14 of them last week, and we got through military, banking, immigration, and religion.
I would also like to point out to everybody, you know, I understand that in today's day and age, with YouTube and TV and everything else, we really don't read much. I've sent out a lot of things to people over the last several months, and, you know, I would question them afterwards on if they had read it and would try and talk to them, but most people don't read. This document is short. It will take you 15 minutes to read it, if that. Do yourself a favor. Go check it out. Read along with it. Try to understand, you know, and it's written in very plain English, so it's easy to read, and it's easy to understand, so... But it's important that we start understanding what the problems are and what the solutions are to fix them. That's the
Let me make a comment about reading, too. The cognitive part of your brain is the one that takes what you read or what you see and deals with it, turns it into thought and allows you to, say, mentally digest that information. If you're watching a YouTube video, the pace is set by the video. So you're going along with that, and if something sparks your interest, you either stop listening to the rest of it with your mind and start thinking about it, or you keep listening to the rest of it, and that thought goes away. Now, when you read, your cognitive process works completely differently than when it does when you're watching a video or even listening to something. So reading allows you the ability to really grasp the subject that you're looking into a lot better than anything else. So as tiring as reading might be, it also burns more calories per hour than watching YouTube. But despite how cumbersome it might seem, if you really want to grasp concepts, reading is the best way to do it. You set your pace. You can stop, think about something. You can go back and read it again, things that you can't possibly do with a YouTube video. So I would suggest you all go to that link and bookmark it and go back and spend time going over these so that you understand each one of them and how significant it would be to, if the government responded to this petition favorably, how quickly we would have our government back in proper working order. So now we're going into the area identified as government authority. The government of the United States was created by authority of the people by means of the Constitution, which is the charter of that government. The government is thereby bound in all of its actions, whether on United States-owned and ceded lands within the states of the Union or outside the boundaries of the United States, by the prohibitions and limitations set forth in the Constitution. That doesn't really demand anything. It sets a premise that wherever you are, your authority to exist. In fact, an article that I wrote a while back, let's talk about the Constitution, and I'll post the link to that, deals with that. Why would the government, if we didn't give them the authority to act in a capacity here, have the authority to act in that capacity elsewhere? And that would include any activity would be illegal here, would be illegal for the government to do elsewhere. The rendering, what do they call it, rendering?
Renditions.
Rendition, that's the word. The rendition that they did, they don't have the authority to do it. So why would we accept that they have the authority to do it? That link I just posted will take you to let's talk about the Constitution, which we'll discuss this very relationship with government. Renditions cannot be conducted if they're not authorized in this country. The government can have no authority that we did not give them. Their source of authority is we the people, as laid out in the Constitution. And so that premise is important. It has to be understood by government. Continuing on, that in light of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, the 9th article in the Amendment to the Constitution and the 10th article in Amendment to the Constitution, the authority of the states and the people shall not be limited by any acts of the Congress. the executive or the judicial branches of the federal government. Now, one is limiting and the other one leaves all remaining authority to the people and or the states. And we all know that they've kind of walked over those responsibilities. So they need to be put back in their place. Next, that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18 shall be strictly construed with regard to necessary and proper for carrying out the foregoing powers, and shall not be broadly construed to extend authority where it was not intended. Now, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 is probably one of the most misunderstood of all the articles in the Constitution. They call it the enabling clause. They're claiming that it enables the government to do anything that they want because they've got the enabling clause. Well, the way it reads, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or any department or officer thereof. Now, it says foregoing powers or any other specific powers that are given. Now, if the powers aren't given, the government has assumed the authority to extend those powers where they're not granted by the Constitution. And, you know, an old example that we've lived with all of our lives is called Social Security, but more recent ones are Medicaid or Medicare, whichever one's the federal one. And how about Obamacare, the health care? None of those have any authority or any foundation in the Constitution. Next, that the Congress shall prepare for presentation to the states of the Union an amendment to the Constitution which would limit terms of office for all federal elected officials to a maximum of 2 terms, and with the exception of president, shall have 1 intervening term out of office, which shall then be submitted to the states for their ratification. So we've got people that have made careers in Congress. This says that if you're a senator or a representative, you only get 2 terms in office. But to have 2 terms, you have to have 1 in, 1 out, and 1 back in. So
there's a reason for that now. You know, and I'd like to talk about that for a moment. You know, some people might disagree with that, but there's a reason for that. One of the most obvious reasons is that no politician, for instance, let's take their pay raises that they get to not vote on or that they vote no on if they don't want them. That would be gone. They would not be doing that anymore. Nobody is going to vote for a pay raise they're not going to receive. And there's no guarantee they'll be elected their next eligibility period. So we'll get rid of a lot of that stuff. You know, we'll get rid of a lot of those power plays and a lot of the dynasty families that we have. We were never intended to be a dynasty country.
Now, it would also force them to go back. Now, most of them are lawyers and would go back and probably be supported by the firm just for the influence they have, but it would force them out of Congress, and at least for that term out, they would be listening rather than talking to what's happening around them. But I think the most important element is the fact that you don't have people, just because they're well-respected, going into their 80th or 90th year of age and being senile or having Alzheimer's disease and being one of those people who is probably easily influenced to go along with his party, and maybe he had wisdom back when he was young, but that left him along with a lot of other things. We don't need those people. Ted Kennedy, how many years did he have there? We don't need that. We need fresh blood that brings new ideas, not old blood that just can't figure out how to make things work and keep trying and trying the same old things over and over again. Next, the Congress will recognize the separation of powers as envisioned by the Founding Fathers and will prohibit any member of the judicial branch, whether state, federal, or both, by virtue of any membership, association, license, or employment, partnership, or fiduciary relationship with any firm practicing under such authority from pursuing an office in the legislative or executive branches of government. that any person at present holding such office shall, at the expiration of his current term, be bound by this condition. Now, what does that say? That means any lawyer, anybody that's a member of a law firm, anybody that has any relationship with a law firm, understand that the bar associations in every state are subject to the authority of the Supreme Court in that state. Therefore, a lawyer in any state, his license is ultimately under the authority of the judicial branch of government or the Supreme Court of that state. The separation power says you shall not be in the executive branch and the judicial branch at the same time. It's separation of powers. That somebody that's in the judicial branch cannot be act in the executive or legislative branch. That would keep all the lawyers out of Congress and out of the White House. Now, laws are rules of action. Now, when attorneys write laws, they write them so that they're ways out. They write them so complexly that there's always loopholes, which keeps the profession going because there's something to banter back and forth. If it's simple and easily understood by everybody, our attorneys can't argue on and on and on. So if they're writing the laws and they're writing them for the benefit of their profession and their clients to make them with loopholes, then what good is that doing us? And if we go back to the original 13th Amendment, the Titles of Nobility Amendment, it would have prohibited lawyers who were members of a bar association from even having citizenship in this country. So back then, the founders recognized that if you become a member of a bar, and they didn't have, there were bar associations back then, but not in this country. There was one in England, members of the Temple. The lawyers here were lettered in the law. The Bar Association in the United States didn't come in until, I think it was 1878, long after the 13th Amendment began disappearing. And since then, now, them being subject to the judicial branch of government and being allowed to operate in the executive and legislative branch, we've got a real mess that absolutely violates the intention of the separation of powers. Going on to the next one, that the Congress shall enact legislation which will provide that by petition of 0.01% of the lawful population, a federal citizen's grand jury can be impaneled within 30 days of the receipt of such petition to hear charges of violations of the Constitution and other laws of the United States, and if a true bill is issued by the grand jury, a jury trial shall be held, peopled by citizens of the state which the accused claims as resident, and within that state, and the verdict and punishment in such trial shall not be questioned by any other authority. This to be created as an inferior court under authority of Article 3, Section 1, and Article 1, Section 8, Clause 9 of the Constitution.
Now, Gary, I would like to go over that part for a moment, if you wouldn't mind, and really spell out what that means and what
okay.
its purpose is, what it does for we the people.
Well, it gives us an executioner's act, so to speak. It gives us the authority if Congress enacts a law, say Obamacare, for example. Let's use that for an example. They enact a law, and we think it's illegal. Now, everybody that voted for Obamacare, we feel that they voted in violation of the Constitution. Every one of them could be indicted. Every one of them could be brought before the federal grand jury with a sufficient number of people signing the petition. And that number is not 1%, not a tenth of 1%, but 1/100 of 1%, or one for every 10,000 people, lawful citizens of this country.
Which is not very many.
It's not very many. It's a reasonable number. It's a large number, so it requires a lot of people being concerned with something. It's not that, you know, 10 people can go up and force the grand jury, but once the grand jury is impaneled, if they find probable cause, then it goes to jury trial, and each of them then would be tried in the state that he claims his residence, which if you're in Florida and he was a representative from Florida, then the jury trial would be in your state. It would put an ultimate power over the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court, as we all know from, if you've read my article in the 27th Amendment, the Ashwander versus TVA, the Supreme Court says, we're not going to rule on the constitutionality unless we have no other recourse. Now, I've been reading about John Marshall, and he felt, and he's the one that really established the policy of judicial review that held until the Ashwander Court, or in the 1920s and 30s, the court began stopping ruling on constitutionality. He set it up, and he explained it quite well, why the Supreme Court has the authority and the responsibility to do judicial review of laws enacted by Congress to determine if they're constitutional or not. But since the court has abrogated that responsibility since 1937, we're in a position now where there is no review to see if it's constitutional. A few items that have gone before the Supreme Court, one was the congressional pay raise, the 27th Amendment, which we'll get to in a few minutes, and the one that Brandy alluded to. There was another one recently, and I don't recall what it was right now. I think it might have been term limits, where the court overturned it because nobody had standing to bring this issue before the court. Nobody had standing? Wait a minute. The contract's between me and the government, and I don't have standing to challenge them violating that contract? At any rate, the means of forcing and then the jury determining guilt and punishment would give us the means of taking ultimate control of this country in determining constitutionality or not, or the laws of the land. By the same token, if a grand jury found somebody guilty of violating a law of the United States, and the petit jury determined that that's an unconstitutional law, then the result of that petit jury goes on record as that's not a valid law. It's not consistent with the Constitution. The power that would come back to us as the ultimate guardians of our own country is embodied in that particular portion of the petitioner, as Randy prefers, and rightfully so, the demand.
This petition.
What?
I said, yeah, this is not a petition.
It's a petition in an archaic sense. It's a petition. A petition should be responded to. If it's not, in a sense, it's a demand to do this. Now, petitions have become so common. You know, there's online petitions, and there's petitions to change the color of the shade of red in the flag. There are all kinds of petitions. Those aren't petitions. We've watered down the purpose and intention of petitions over the years, and I think there's probably a good reason for that. It suits the government quite well because they can laugh at some of these petitions. But in the archaic sense, this is a petition, which is a demand. You do these things. If you don't, you cease to represent it, as we pointed out at the beginning of this. So anyway, going on to the next one, all administrative agencies of government shall be stripped of rulemaking authority, and that all rules enforced by any such agency shall henceforth be created directly and specifically by an enactment of the Congress and passed into law as prescribed by the Constitution. Now, I'm going to post a link to who makes the laws now. And I think you'll find this rather interesting, because basically what it says, and they admitted in 1946 that they were creating a fourth branch of government. If you read the article, there are quotes from the Congressional Record where they acknowledge that they're creating the fourth branch of a government, and in a government that was created by the Constitution with only three branches of government. And administrative agencies, Congress might enact something, but the administrative agencies, then when they write their rules, can get more detailed. They can start manipulating things to make them more coercive. All kinds of things can happen when you give that ultimate authority for the final wording of a law to these administrative agencies. And these administrative agencies are self-serving and self-perpetuating. They want to become larger because that makes the head of the agency that much more important. They want to increase their funding. All their motivation is for power. And to give them the authority that they were granted in 1946 with the Administrative Agencies Act is absurd under our Constitution. Okay, next. That any agreement currently existing between any administrative agency of the federal government which binds, obligates, or otherwise coerces compliance by any state agency, or any other entity within any of the states is null and void, and that no future attempts to create such relationship may ever be enacted or otherwise imposed. Now, the federal government gives something like $35 a day or $3,000 a year for each student in school. They've taken our money away from the states and away from us. It goes to Washington. 80% of it gets lost administratively, and the 20% comes back. When it comes back, it binds the school, whether it's a private institution that receives any federal funds, a college, a university, the public school system, or anything. All of a sudden, they're bound by the rules of that agency, the condition that they accept it. I wrote an article back in the 90s, and I don't know if I have a quick link to it, but it had to do with the Crime Control Act, and I don't have a quick link to it right now, to the Crime Control Act of 1994. And it was you might recall, it was the cops on the street. They were going to put more cops on the street, so they enacted this law, and basically they said, we'll give you the first, we'll pay the salary of the new cop for the first year, three-quarters of the salary second year, half the salary third year, quarter of the salary fourth year, and the fifth year you're on your own. But don't worry, we'll teach you how to raise revenue to offset the cost of that new employee by teaching you how to asset forfeiture. But also in that bill, it said that once you accept these funds, you are bound to the policies established by the Department of Justice. Now, that's one of the strings for money. Just like the highway funds, when there was Drive 55, a state could lose its highway funds from the federal government if the traffic flow exceeded a certain amount. These strings are very strong. What's taught in school and what can't be taught in school quite often is the manipulation of the Department of Education, the revenue source for the school, by saying, you can't teach that or you have to teach this. This is why all the states had a choice of either going with the federal, whatever they call it, you know, the showing you're learning something, or come up with the state test that demonstrated that which had to meet federal criteria to show that the students are learning. And so now in school,
so the No Child Left Behind.
What?
Was that the No Child Left Behind policy they were implementing?
Well, it was beyond that. There's a testing thing, and my kids are homeschooled now, so we don't have to deal with it. But there's, I think, three or four times during the 12-year education that students have to
aptitude test.
What?
The aptitude test.
No, it's not aptitude. Aptitude shows what, you know, if you're a good mechanic or might be a lawyer or a painter or something like that. It's showing that you got an education. Does anybody on the chat recognize what I'm talking about? Do you recall the name of that? It's to demonstrate that you've learned. But see, they have to do that. The state has to do that to get that federal money coming down. That's one of the conditions of the strings attached. So this provision that I just read would strip the government of the authority to bind or create obligations or coerce compliance by any state agency or any other entity within any of the states. Now, the reason any other entity is a private university. Hillsdale College is the only college in this country that will not take federal funds. And they have a whole different set of rules. They're not bound by all the stuff that everybody else is. Every other college and university in this country, even though they're not government entities, if they've taken money, they have subordinated to the Department of Education as far as curriculum, policy, and everything else. it will get rid of that federal control. It's a subtle influence. Most people don't even realize it exists unless they read the laws and see that it does. Okay, next, that the Congress will prohibit its members from receiving any emolument except his prescribed salary, gift, benefit, or favors while in office. Any member accused to be in violation shall be reviewed by the appropriate House's Ethics Committee, and if found to have received such emolument, gift, benefit, or favor, shall be immediately expelled from that House and not be qualified to return. Now, that's pretty clear. If they found that, yeah, he accepted a gift, but it wasn't a big gift, doesn't matter. He accepted a gift, he's expelled. We're telling Congress the Constitution gave you the authority to, you know, to oversee what happens in your house, but you will. They tell us they want zero tolerance. We want zero tolerance, too. I don't care if you've got a cigarette from the guy. If it's in violation, he will be expelled and he will never return. You know they get gifts. That's obvious. And they only go after the congressmen that don't vote the party line.
Well, they get gifts. They get trips and vacations. They get appointments to boards after they get out of office.
Well, that would cause immediate expulsion. Okay, next. Now, this one may not be on the one online. I don't know if I updated it when I added this or not, but as I said, when Randy and I put this together the first time, it was done in a very short period of time, and some things came up later in talking with people. It was posted on a lot of Ning sites, and I got a lot of comments back, and so some things came up that were worth consideration. So the next one is that the Congress is not a benefactor or philanthropic organization, and is prohibited from redistribution of any revenue under the form of grants, scholarships, endowments, research funds, or any other form which does not have a direct and identifiable return to the government of all the funds received. That would cut Acorn out. Acorn's gone. They don't make money, they just take money. Anybody. Now, research, global warming. You get a grant to study atmospheric conditions, and you get a subtle message from the people that issue that grant that, well, we know global warming's occurring, and if you want us to continue your grant, you will prove that global warming is occurring. So these guys, these professors, man, they're getting hundreds of thousands of dollars a year into their grant program. And they know that if they want the grant continued next year, they better prove that there's global warming or that frogs can have sex with flies. Whatever they have to prove, they will prove because they want the grant next year. Now, the government is not a benefactor or a philanthropic or organization. It should not be giving money unless there's a direct return. If we give them $100,000, we should get at least $100,000 back. Just like you or me, if we invested in a corporation that was start up and going to do research and try and develop a product, we would expect a return on our money. And we'd look into it very closely to make sure that we would get, there's a good chance that we would get that return. Well, why can't the government show the same thoughtfulness before they contribute our money as we would if we were contributing our own money? Another one that was added after the first one went out is that Congress is senior to any private organization and cannot contract with, support, depend upon, restrict to, or allow a federal employee to be a member of any union or any collective bargaining union in any shape, form, or relationship. Now, there's a problem when unions have control over government employees. The ability to strike can be potentially very dangerous. In fact, some cities and counties have had problems with firemen striking. But the federal government is what we're dealing with, so we can't deal with the fire departments at the state level. The federal government cannot have any unions. Now, a good example of union in the federal level, which would be agencies of the government, is the U.S. Postal Service. Even though it's a contract organization, it has a union for the postmen. I guess you can't call them that anymore, can you? That's political correctness. I'll call them postmen, the mailmen. There is a union for them. My brother was a mailman. He's retired now. But he was one of the stewards for the union. And they have a lot of influence over the, you know, what people get paid, how long they have to work. So our costs go up when we've got any union influencing any part of government, any agency, anything that's a service provided by the federal government. If there's a union associated with it, we're going to get screwed. There is no reason for that. Jobs are interesting. There's an old saying I learned many years ago. What were you doing when you came here? Looking for a job. What will you be doing when you leave here? Looking for a job. It's very simple. Take the job as it is. Don't take the job to go in and try and change what it's worth. If you can prove you're worth more, you might get it. But to have a union prove that you're worth more when you're worth less by joining the union doesn't make sense, especially when it's public money that's being spent. There's no reason. Now, a private corporation might resist influenced by the union, exorbitant wages, for example, or exorbitant benefits. But the federal government doesn't have to worry about it. Well, it's not our money. Yeah, give them everything they want.
Yeah, you're basically giving organizations control of your tax dollars and demand and the ability to demand more from you. That's what that amounts to. Their demand for you to pay them more money and get it. And you have no say in the matter.
Okay, now we've gone through 25 of these items, and I think, let me check real quick, I think there are 35 of them.
I'll tell you what, let's save these last ones for the next show, so we'll make the document a three-part series.
Okay.
We've got about an hour left. I'd like to start going through the committees of safety and the militia and the role and the aspects that these two organizations, what role they play, you know, historically as well as today.
Sounds good to me, but for those of you who have the link
down, give them a little bit of time to digest what we've gone over so far. Go ahead. What was that?
Just for the people listening, go to the link that we put up and read this over and think about it. Now, I want to say one thing about this. One thing, when we started posting it everywhere and getting people's reactions, I found people that had objection to one or two items. And they said they wouldn't sign the petition because they objected to this one or that one. And one of the ones, obviously, my guess is they were attorneys, is they didn't like the one, the separation of powers. They didn't like that. They didn't like that as an attorney. I can't be a legislator. But people would say, because of that one item out of 35, or those two items out of 35, most often it was just one, I will not sign the petition. Now, how absurd is it to say that if I've got 3% of that petition is bad and 97% is good, that I would rather live with what I have now than get a 97% positive change? Are we shooting ourselves in the foot by saying one bad item and we're going to throw the whole thing out and live with what we got? Or can we swallow our pride and say, look, I can accept that one or maybe two items and get by with 94% positive. But to get support behind this petition, this demand, if we could get that support and people to put aside those petty little concerns that are destructive of the whole change of correction, think of how much better off we'd be. If we could get 2 or 3 million people to demand that Congress abide by this petition, imagine how quickly we would get our country back peacefully.
Hell, just the power of the federal grand jury back in the hands of we the people within a very specific time period, just that alone would be... it would be incredible change. Most people can't even understand what that kind of power would give us. If only that got done, we could solve the problems of our country very quickly.
Now think of the Constitution and even the Articles of Confederation, and let's even go back to the Declaration of Independence. Even though Most often, the appearance to the rest of the world was unanimous in creation. The Declaration of Independence, Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution, it was not. And Franco, instead, when you consider how many people are involved here, I think that this may not be perfect, but it's the best we're going to get with all these people involved. Now, I've tried to be as objective as, Randy and I have tried to be as objective as possible in putting this together. There are things that I might not like, but I've heard so much clamor in the Patriot community that they got to be in there. So we have to look at the fact that when you've got enough people, there have to be concessions on occasion. So if you don't like one item, it's still worthwhile. And think also how good a project this would be for committees of safety to go through their neighborhood, their community, and get people to sign these petitions. So speaking of committees of safety, I think we ought to talk about committees of safety, Randy. What do you think?
Let's go into it. That's okay. One of my favorite subjects anymore. And it is vital. It's so important anymore. Let's start off with what they are. Let's go into that, Gary.
Well, committees of safety go back in American history. Well, let's see. Just recently, I asked a guy about committees of safety, and he went online somewhere, and I don't know what he looked at, but he came back with a definition, and the only reference he found to committee of safety was what happened in France in the 1780s.
Oh, that was me. That was me.
Oh, that was you. Okay,
encyclopedia.
You. What encyclopedia was that?
International Encyclopedia, I believe. Let me go whip it out real quick, in fact. Hang on a second.
So we've got
my library area.
We've got a book, International Encyclopedia, that says committees of safety were in France. And that's where all the blood flowed down the streets as they lopped heads off. Committee of Safety goes back in English heritage long, long ago. The earliest occurrence in this country was in 1692. I haven't gone to England, except we can look at the roots of committees of safety all the way back as far as the Magna Carta. So, for a book to try and demonize committees of safety by saying, hey, think of all the blood that was shed by the committees of safety, I'd like to take their heads and put them on the street. But that's what happens when you've got people that are intent on us not taking control of our own lives. You heard Schaefer Cox last night, and you got to take control of your own lives. Now, how can you do that as a community, as a committee of safety? Why would people want to quash that idea? Because it's awesome in respect to if people develop into committees of safety, the power force in this country shifts from the government who has usurped it back to the people who created and own it. So nothing can be said better for the committees of safety than the fact that internationalists do not want it to be recognized as something fundamental to the creation of our country. Right, Randy?
That's pretty much it. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at the 1982 pub date of Encyclopedia International, book 5, goes from Colburn to Dice, and there's only one reference of Committee of Public Safety here. Emergency body established on April 6, 1793, during the French Revolution by the National Convention, consisting at first of 9 members chosen from among the deputies for 1 month at a time. The committee was expanded to 12 members. It goes on and on. It goes into the bloody reign of terror. In fact, that's what it's called, the reign of terror, under the leadership of Maximilien de Robespierre and other radical Jacobians. And that's what it says about it. It gives a two-sentence spiel about committees of correspondence, almost no reference to their importance or anything, just the fact that Samuel Adams started them, and they were quickly copied everywhere.
And understand the committees of correspondence that evolved in, sometimes they retained their name, but they evolved into effective committees of safety later on. But his purpose in setting up the committees of correspondence which in a sense was modeled after the Committee of Safety, but its primary purpose was to make sure the other colonies knew what was happening in Boston and in Massachusetts.
Right, they were the communication link between the other committees.
But committees of safety existed long before that. So don't let the internationalists... Well, you know, that's kind of the greatest thing that could be said about committees of safety is they want to hide it. What can I say? They want to hide it from us. They want to deceive us. They want to demonize the concept. So what does it take to build a committee of safety? Well, you need a community. That could be a city. It could be the northeast part of the county. It could be the south part of the county. It could be the whole county. It could be two cities. There were committees of safety on plantations in the northern states where there were plantations where people were given a house and they worked for the plantation owner. Some of those plantations had their committees of safety. They can be any geographic boundaries that you decide them to be. You can start out small and grow it, or you can merge some city or smaller ones into a county committee. And realistically, though, from what I can tell, three people can be a committee of safety if they assert themselves as a committee of safety, as they join with others and want to create a county committee. If they've got three little areas within the county, they can make a county committee. If they've got three counties committees, they can make a state committee. Now, I'm just guessing at the numbers based on what I was able to read. Three to five seems to be about the minimum amount in different references. Three or five was the minimum amount that could constitute a committee. Is there many of committees of safety or one? Well, think of the structure. The Continental Congress was recalled by the Committee of Safety. One of the first calls came out of New York Committee of Safety. Interesting, New York City Committee of Safety. Interestingly, they were trying to put off discussing the non-importation agreement because with the Dutch influence there, they didn't want importation to stop. So they figured they could delay things by calling for a committee of safety, for a continental convention or Congress. So they called for the Congress, and Boston went along with that, and then everybody went along with it, or almost everybody. So they had the first Continental Congress, which was the non-importation agreement. If you go to committee.org and look on the first page, John Hancock was saying every community should start a committee of safety. So if you have a county committee, it's probably better to have three or four committees that are local where people back then had to walk to the meetings. They couldn't drive. But where you're with people that you know and deal with almost on a day-to-day basis, your neighbors. So depending on the geography of the county, you should have one in every little pocket. But then they can each send a representative to the county committee. So if you've got seven little pockets, you could have seven or 14 or 21 members in the county committee, one from each. Or you could structure it based on how many members you had in a committee where if for every 10 members, you got to send one member up to the county committee. Whatever you structure it, there's nothing defined. Nobody's written a book on exactly how to establish a committee of safety. But at each level, you've gone up. Now, speaking of representation, what better representation can you have than what the founders had when they did the Declaration, when they did the Articles of Confederation, when they had the Continental Congresses, than having everybody pushing up their sympathies, having their feelings pushed forward, and then being brought together at the next level, and then pushed forward to the county level, and then pushed forward and then brought together as a majority on the state level, and then the colony level, and then all the colonies come together. And with equal representation, they come up with the ideas that came out of those little committees way down at the bottom.
Well, hang on a second. I got a question real quick for you from Equalizer in the chat room. Here's his question. Since my state constitution states, between a certain age, I am a part of the state's militia, what does this committee of safety have to do with me or my militia unit?
Well, going back to the Magna Carta, quite simply, the Magna Carta has the first elements of what we might call militia. But everybody could have a sword or a bow or the weapons, but he was under allegiance or obedience to a civil authority. And that tradition, go back to Washington. Washington was very absolute. I am subordinate to the Congress, the civil authority. The committees of safety were responsible or subordinate to committees of safety or the royal governor. That obedience to civil authority keeps us from having a city-state mentality or a warlord mentality. That subordination to civil authority has held the British Empire together for almost 1,000 years. When you're in the militia, in accordance to your constitution, your obedience is to the governor. That's it. However, what happened back 230 years ago is if the governor didn't do anything and something needed to be done, the Committee of Safety would direct people to do something. Now, what's happening in Arizona right now, we have a right to respond and defend our borders. But ideally, these people would either subordinate to Jan Brewer or the governor of their state, or they would do as the colonists did and transfer that authority to a committee of safety so that there is subordination to the civil authority. Now, what that civil authority does too, it doesn't matter if you elect your officers or if they're appointed by the committee. The thing is, the commission has to come from the committee. Most of the committees back then would allow elections within companies to determine who the company officers were, and then they would commission those officers. And we run into situations like, who's the guy from Vermont? The Green Mountain Boys. They would not subordinate to Benedict Arnold when they went to Fort Ticonderoga. They would only accept the officership, and a lot of people around Boston would only accept the officership that was given to them, that was commissioned by their Committee of Safety, their civil authority. So, now, the obedience to civil authority traditionally rests with the existing government. If the existing government fails to do its job, as it did in Massachusetts, then you shift it to the Committee of Safety. But it has to be subordinate to civil authority. That's our heritage. That's how we had a transition of government that was peaceful, because the militias assigned it to the Committees of Safety. The Committees of Safety began almost immediately creating a new government by creating the Continental Congress, by then coming up with state constitutions, and then the Articles of Confederation. The whole progression was a transition of government from royal authority to the authority of the people themselves. So you are, at this point in time, your obedience is to the governor. And if you have no other place to place that, you can't take it away from the governor. You have no right to remove yourself from that civil authority, even though that civil authority is doing nothing. But if something stands up as a civil authority, a committee of safety, that will take responsibility or is consistent with what your beliefs are as the militia, then you transfer it. No, it's not the same as the sheriff. Civil authority is considered to be a body. The committees of safety were not much different than the town meeting. It was the body of the people. To give it to one man would be completely contrary, even in England, would be completely contrary to the whole concept of civil authority. That is not one man. Now, when we say the governor is the representative of the people in the state. That's the only place to lay it. But to give it to the sheriff, understand now the sheriff has ties to the federal government. I explained them a little while ago when we were talking about the demand. The sheriff is receiving federal money. He's obliged by the Department of Department of Justice. There are exceptions. And I suppose if you had Sheriff Mack as an elected sheriff in your county, you might want to subordinate to him. But I would say be very wary right now, because the sheriff in most cases has those strings. And I don't know if Sheriff Mack dissolve those strings to the federal government or not, but I would be very reluctant to put them in the hands of anybody that had subordinated himself to the government in Washington. You elect your sheriff to be your law enforcement. Yes, you do, but remember those ties. Go down to the sheriff sometime, ask him if he receives any federal funds, and if he says yes, ask him what strings are tied to those federal funds. I want to know what obligations you have to abide by to receive those federal funds. See if you can get out of him what they are. Ask him to see the paperwork that he had to sign to get those federal funds. They don't just write a check and send it. Believe me, there's a contract. So ask him to see that contract. See what he's what he's given up of your rights as a consequence of his receipt of those federal funds. Yeah, well, Ranger. It's not Ranger. Anyway, you're right. They can be awful scary. I mean, these guys are politicians for the most part, and they get phenomenal salaries. And most of them really have no desire to protect the people in their county. All they want to do is increase their power with their deputies. Any more questions about that point? Who grants them the authority? You mean the committees of safety, Equalizer?
Yes, who grants the committees of safety authority?
People. Where does the ultimate authority come from? Let me read you something. Maybe this will give you an idea. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, etc., etc., to ourselves and our posterity. Where did the authority come from? Let me go back to another one. When in the course of human, let's see, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. Now, who would institute that government? If you don't have a king, that government is either instituted by force or by the people. Now, the whole concept in this country is that government's instituted by the people. So, who has the authority to create a committee of safety? 3 to 5 people in your community that want to. Now, it doesn't affect, you don't have jurisdiction over everybody in your community if you got 3 or 5 people. But they have clustered together outside because they've seen that the contract was violated. They've contracted outside to establish, outside the, you know, the existing structure of government, to look out for themselves. And they're willing to participate with other committees of safety, people who have stepped outside of the authority granted by them. Let me go a little further in that second document I was reading. Let's see, I've got to find it. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, driving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now, if you go back and read John Locke, Second Treatise of Government, and I think it's chapter 19, maybe it's 14, but he talks about that relationship to government. He says that once you have a government, you can't withdraw from it because you've got a solemn obligation to support that government. But he does say also that if that government breaches his contract, if it usurps authority that it does not have, and this is the whole foundation, the whole Declaration of Independence and the thought of the people at the time was they have breached the contract. They have released the contract by violating the contract. If I have a contract with you that you have to give me $100 every time I give you 20 pounds of fish, you got to give me $100 every time I give you 20 pounds of fish. If I don't give you 20 pounds of fish, I've breached the contract. If you don't give me the $100, you've breached the contract. Same thing with the government. If they don't abide by the contract, they've breached it. Once they've breached it, no, that's not the site. It's committeesingular.org. That guy's got some things wrong. If you go there, he's predicating the whole thing on Agnes Hunt's book, which dealt only with the colonial committees of safety. That's the level just before the Continental Congress. He does not address the local committees of safety from whence this authority evolved up to the colonial level. He totally ignores it. So Randy's got it up there, committee.org. So this, the authority for a committee of safety obviously comes from the people. The Declaration, Locke, who wrote his Second Treatise of Government, which they built the Declaration and the whole concept of government on, even the Constitution acknowledges the authorities with the people. So if you have, if the government has divested you by breach of contract, you have two choices. You live in a state of nature, or you find some people that think like you do and recreate a government that's more suitable to your needs and consistent with the Constitution. We're not throwing the Constitution out. We're throwing out the government that doesn't abide by the Constitution. So as long as you abide by the English heritage that has passed down for 1,000 years and evolved, and abide by the contract, then you have every right in the world to establish yourself in a protective group called a Committee of Safety to govern yourselves. You heard Schaefer Cox last night. Basically, they've done that. They're coexisting with the king's government, the state police, the ATF, and all these other agencies. They're coexisting, but they've asserted themselves. I don't know if they have a committee of safety up there. I didn't listen to the entire program. But if they don't, they're missing one element, the most important one, to give legitimacy to what they do, and that is the committee of safety. You talk for a while. I got to drink something.
Not a problem. Actually, we got a question in there. somebody asked if I thought we had time. And I would like to go over why I think we do have time. Hang on one second. I've got to switch phones here.
Why we have what now?
Sorry about that. Somebody was asking if I thought we had time to start implementing this, and I think we do, and here's why. Unlike most people out there, I go and I read all the documents being put out by the organizations that are bringing about this internationalism, this globalism that we're talking about, the very thing that we're trying to stay away from. And I see them writing laws that they want to have the U.S. implement well into the year 2020. Gun laws. You know, we're still going to have guns, according to the UN, in the year 2020. They're writing property laws that don't come into effect until 2018 that deal with single-family residents for building code. So, yes, I think we do have time. You know, I understand that everybody feels that we're, you know, come November, we're done. That's just not quite the way it is. You know, if you read the UN, if you read the agendas that are coming out and the documents, they say we are slowly going to do this until about the year 2050. Around the year 2050, all of those, meaning all of those who opposed us, meaning you and me and most of us on this call and many others, well, we'll just be dead by then. And they'll have indoctrinated the youth from that point on, this point on, so well, it won't be a problem anymore. So, you know, I know that that there's a lot of shows out there, and all they do is preach doom and gloom, and they make all these predictions that never come true. Let's keep that in mind. They never come true. They have never come true. I've been hearing them for 20-some years. They never come true.
However, keep in mind that if they said 2020 and expected it told us 2020 and snuck it in a couple years early, it wouldn't be beyond them. One, the plan was moving along smoother than expected, or two, they wanted to just distract us before they clamped down real hard. So, you know,
this is true.
It's a good guide. Now, what is
right? It's a good guide, but that goes to my next point. We work today to start building the infrastructure we need tomorrow, and the quicker we start getting to work on it, well, the more secure we are for the future.
Right.
So it's kind of up to you guys how quickly it takes, and I mean, how long does it take to get 3 to 5 guys together that are, you know, look at your own militia units out there. Start there. Those guys that are past their prime, or those guys, or those individuals who are more civic or politically minded, they would probably serve a better purpose somewhere else. Have them give up their commission in the militia, form a committee of safety with them. So if you've got a large militia and you've got, you know, 30, 40 guys that are past their prime, that are well, you know, that are pretty level-headed and well-educated, well, get them to do this. You're off to a good start now. Those that don't, you know, start looking around, and if you're past your prime, then you're a perfect, then you're a prime candidate for this. And if you can't hump a 60 to 80 pound pack all day, well then, you know, if you've got knee problems like myself, you know, I can't go out there and I can't hump all day like I used to. If given the option, whether to be in a militia or a committee of safety, I would choose the committee of safety. I would serve a better purpose there.
Yeah,
so that's kind of where it's at now. You know, we live by example, and we start implementing today in preparation for tomorrow.
We've got to understand that there's not urgency. It doesn't have to be done tomorrow, but then there's not the luxury of squandering our time and putting it off. For example, staying at the computer all the time instead of going out and spending 2 or 3 hours a day in your community trying to educating people on committees of safety and enlisting them into the idea. Patrick Henry back then said, you know, every day they're going to get stronger. Are we going to wait until there's a British soldier in every house? The quicker we move, the less severe the obstacle. For example, when they outlaw guns, they've got an excuse to arrest almost anybody. So if we move along at a good, smooth pace, educate people properly and bring them up to par, but is I don't want to say as rapidly as possible, but at a good, steady rate, the sooner we get our act together, the better off we are if the battle has to be fought. Hopefully, if we get committees of safety together and say the committees of safety get behind these demands in every community, mostly communities in the country, and get 2 or 3 million people to fill out these petitions and send them to 3 people, we might avoid the gunfight. And I would love that, but I want my country back. If it takes shooting, it takes shooting. If we can do it peacefully, and as I explained on the last show, for many years, is there a peaceful solution? Nobody could answer me. Then Randy and I got talking, and I realized I had never asked myself that question. So we put our heads together and came up with an idea, and that's what we've been going over these last week and this week, and we'll finish next week, of something that would give us a phenomenal edge. We would have the Constitution back. There might be a little few strings to deal with, but when you think that at least at that point we would have the, especially with the grand jury, we would have the authority to judge government performance. If they weren't performing correctly, we deal with it as the people that own this country. So, yes, we have time, but don't take advantage of the time, take advantage of the opportunity. Now, there's been talk about courts, too, and Quiznos familiar, he and I have spoken a number of times about this. Courts are no different than militia. If you read The End of the Revolution and The Beginning of Independence, it's a long read, believe me, but, hey, you're reading something that somehow somebody forgot to tell you when you were going to school. It got lost, kind of like committees of safety got lost in the discussion of committees of safety in the encyclopedia. But The End of the Revolution, Beginning of Independence, will talk about the year before Lexington and Concord, how the courts were taken over by the people. They did so with the authority of the committees of safety, or there were a number of different names or different organizations then, but in concept they were all committees of safety. They were groups of people in the community who'd come together, whatever they called themselves. Most common was committee of safety, but there were many. They were associations, they were organizations. They all had the same purpose, though, to represent the community.
Do you mind if I jump in here real quick for a second? I wanted to reiterate a point that you had made earlier. You know, the real purpose of the committees of safety, if we look back in history, we find what their real purpose was. It was to, during the Revolution, their real purpose was directing, was being that governmental body that was needed. And after the Revolution was won, when we didn't have a government, they were the government. It was a government body that was already established. That's what kept us from being like France and having revolution upon revolution upon revolution afterwards. They were that civil authority body that was already established that kept peace and kept law and order within our communities.
Well, you said when the government didn't exist, but remember it did. First Continental Congress, Second Continental Congress, Third Continental Congress.
Right,
Congress,
but what were the Continental Congresses?
What were they made of?
What were they comprised of?
The people sent up by the committees of safety.
Exactly.
That
was my point. We were that government in the meantime.
They weren't sent down to us by the political parties. They were sent up by the committees of safety. Think of the difference between those two. And next week when we get into the next section of this, you're going to perhaps see the way to curtail the power of the political parties, and they should be curtailed. But yes, there was, we were never without a government, never, not one day during the entire course of the Revolution. We never went without government in place. Sometimes it was in question whether, especially in places like New Jersey, where the British would come in, and then the colonists, the Patriots would come back, and then the British, you know, it went back and forth, and you know, the Tories were in power, the Whigs were in power in doing all sorts of things. But there was never a time without government as long as battle wasn't going on in that place.
Right. Yeah, that was my point. I probably misstated what I was saying. It was, you know, the Articles of Confederation weren't incorporated yet. You know, there was no Constitution yet was my point. We hadn't formalized what that government was going to look like.
Right. The Continental Congress was acting as a Continental Committee of Safety. They appointed Washington in charge. They set up committees for Navy. They put for Ways and Means. They set up all these committees for people to go out and start operating as a de facto government. The government, not a de jure government, but a de facto. De jure government, not a de facto government. They went out and started operating as a government, even though there was no real contract until the Articles of Confederation. So the Continental Congress stayed there and made sure the best they could that there were quotas of militia from the various states and later on quotas of regular troops from the states. They made sure that funding was available or food or supplies were available to the extent that they could. But they operated in the capacity of a government, absent a government, until the Articles of Confederation were adopted. So we never went without, even though the charter for the government did not exist. And that's the beauty of the committees of safety on a local level as well. You're operating without a charter, but with the authority that comes down through our English heritage all the way down to today. So let's see, the end of the Revolution, I posted that link a little while ago. It's a long read, as I say, but I think if you read that, and there's sites in there. I mean, I don't just say this happened, that happened, as Randy's pointed out before. There are quotes in there from the people at the time, what they've done, observations of what occurred. My words give the background and tie the pieces together, but most of the words in there, you'll see quotations all the way through, those come from documents from that period, 1774 and early 1775. It's a long read, but I think when you read it, you'll find out that you got screwed out of understanding where this country came from. That we actually forced the government, which we're talking about now with all the branch petitions, forced the government, General Gates, to do something. And that something was to go to Concord and try and seize the arms. He ran into some patriots who were called by the Committee of Safety in Lexington. There was a battle. And then he went on to Concord, and the committees of safety from the surrounding area had sent their militias forth. There were at least seven militias from seven different committees or communities that came into Concord. Axton, Woburn, Concord, some of the people from Lexington came. Can't think of the other ones right now, but I've identified at least seven different committees of safety were at Concord before the British or shortly after the British got there. The one from Axton were the ones at North Bridge where Captain Davis was killed, and along with another member from Axton, two of the Americans that died at Concord. They'd come from Axton and stood at the bridge. They just got
there. Yeah, I forgot their names. What the hell were their names? I'm getting old, man. My memory has begun slipping since I turned 40. It starts with names and dates. I cannot recall their names, to be honest with you right now.
Yeah, I've got a letter that was written by the wife of one of the guys that died, and I've got another letter written by the wife of a husband who didn't want a war, but he went to Concord. It was foisted upon them. They had no choice. And there's a good movie out. It was written by Howard Fast, and Howard Fast is, I got doubts about him as some of his writings, but the one called April Morning, which was made into a movie, the story is very interesting because one of the key players in it did not want a war, and he kept saying no. His son wanted to stand with the Patriots, and he said, no, we'll go to the committee meeting, but no, we're not going to war. That is our government. But reality hit so many people on April 19th, especially in Lexington, 1775. And a kind of compelling scene is one of these guys is killed on the running battle along Battle Road when the British were trying to get back to Boston. And as he's dying, he said, all this sorrow over him. And he said, don't worry, I'm proud, I die an American. And that was it. He died an American. That morning, he was not an American. He was a British subject. That afternoon, when he died, he was an American. That one day's event created the dividing line, and those that took the right side became the United States of America. And they died Americans, every one of them. So we got any more questions out there?
No, not that I saw yet. I'm going to give EQ a call later on and help fill him in a little bit more. But I would encourage this. We can talk to you about it, but again, go back to what Garrett and I were talking about. The Internet should be used as a tool. It should not be a lifestyle. So my first recommendation to you, for everybody out there, go to www.committee.org, and spend a couple of days there. Read things over a couple of times. There's a lot of history there, a lot of reference material, a lot from our from the founding fathers themselves, their words on what the committees were and how vitally important they are, the role they played. Spend a couple of days there. Digest some of that information. And then afterwards, send Gary an email. Send myself an email. Let us know what your questions are. But I would highly recommend anybody that listens to this show go to committee.org and spend a couple of days just reading there. Forget about reading about blogs and news and media trivia. Forget that. Start educating your mind. It's only by reading about things like this that you're going to be able to start formulating plans. If you don't understand, you're not going to be able to benefit from it because you won't implement properly. So spend a couple of days reading, digest the information, that hit Gary up, get myself up. We'll be more than happy to spend time with you on it.
Yeah, if anybody wants to get a group of people together and have a conference call, we can set it up on Blog Talk or through Skype or anything where if you have a group of people that are interested and want to learn more about committees of safety, Randy or I would be glad to get on a conference call and help people understand these things.
So, yeah, if you have Skype, my Skype ID is Randy_Mac. If you're not sure if more than one Randy Mac comes up, look for the one in New Mexico. So, again, that's Randy_Mac. It's a free way to conference call with people. You can actually have voice conversation with multiple people at once. So hit me up on that. Gary, you're on Skype as well, so if you want to toss it out there, go ahead. If not, whatever. My email is randymack@youhavetreadonme.com.
Those who want to contact me on Skype, I finally got it working with my 64-bit processor. And, what is it, Gary Hunt OPF? Gary.Hunt OPF, I guess?
Gary.Hunt OPF.
Yeah. And Ironside, if you're listening, I got you on there now, too. Yeah, I'm posting some links of some articles that talk about some of the things we've talked about. Not Committee of Safety. Probably ought to do some more writing. You go to committee.org and spend a couple hours looking around there. Down at the bottom, there's a little box with six different links in it. Go down to those and start looking around there. Quizno can tell you where to go. But there are some PDFs, downloadable information, things like that, that you might find interesting. There is one that I haven't finished putting some of the documents in, but some pertinent documents. There's copies of the original documents that came from committees to safety or addressed committees to safety to give you an idea. These things were real. They were prolific. They were all over the colonies, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, every
state. Even Texas had their associations.
Well,
Associations in Texas that were the committees that were basically the Committee of Safety.
Right.
They called them associations there.
Yeah, somebody came up, questioned, said, well, what about Texas? And I did a little research and found out that they did have basically committees of safety in Texas. They had associations that sent their representatives to, I can't even remember what town it was now, and these are the guys then that started getting together and organizing the government of Texas long before the Alamo. I mean, they followed the same steps that the colonies did. And probably ought to write something about that sometime, but when I do, I'll make sure I let you know. But it was kind of enlightening. The guy asked me a question, and I went to answer it and did a little research, and yes, they did, exactly, as they should. And to find a link.
I agree. So
paste it in there.
I encourage everybody to go there, www.committee.org again. Can't put it out there enough. Now, spend a few days reading. You know, your brain retains 60% of the information when you read. When you watch something on video, it retains less than 6% of it. You have to watch a video many times just to get the benefit of reading once. So spend some time reading. Educate your mind. Remember, a republic, a free people are only free if they remain educated and aware. You can't be free. If you're not educated, you can't be free. And your mind is your most powerful weapon against tyranny there is, against anything. Against any wrong done against you, you know, the better informed you are, the more educated you are, the better off you'll be in life. So if we want to be free, let's start freeing our minds and let's start really learning.
Yeah, I'm going to post a link to Patrick Henry's speech. Those of you who haven't read it or haven't read it in a long time, especially those who are saying, do we have time to do this? Read what he said. He didn't say we got to start today, but he said we got to get our act together today. And he said if there's going to be a war, let it come. That's it. We got to put our foot down and say we're going to get our country back or there's going to be a war. And if we can find a way of getting that country back without a war, it will be through committees of safety. It won't be through the Democrats. It won't be through the Republicans. It won't be through the Tea Parties. It will be through the committees of safety. So, let's see, Randy, where do we go now?
Well, we're down to our last 5 minutes.
Let me finish what I started about when I referenced the end of the revolution, beginning of independence. When they kicked out the judges, there was still the problem of dealing with crime. They decided they were not going to deal with civil matters because one of the big issues then was foreclosure of property or taking property for debt. So they said, we're going to put the civil stuff aside. But they established their own courts under the authority of the Committee of Safety to deal with criminal actions so that somebody charged with a crime, even being a Tory in many places, being a Tory, inimical to the cause of American freedom, was the phrase that was used, inimical to the cause of American freedom, would be tried, and if they were found guilty, they would be told, you're under house arrest, we will take your long rifles. They let them keep pistols for self-defense, but they took their long rifles and said, you stay home, you don't go anywhere. And that was quite a burden on people. They couldn't go down and go, his wife had to go shopping if he was married. If he was not married, he had to get people to go shopping for him to work his, you know, he just had to survive by basically being in house arrest. These courts were making sure that we maintained justice, at least from a criminal standpoint, throughout the period of the revolution. And they also found guys guilty that stuck with the government, which is great. Okay, I'm sorry I interrupted you. I wanted to make that point.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay.
So basically, that's where we're at now. Committees of safety, like I said, you need basically 3 to 5 people to form one. You know, there's nothing written in stone about how they're formed. Now, Gary has an incredible PDF that you can download on committee.org that goes through the history of the committees, and then it goes into a sample layout for a committee. Now, at first, you might not have enough people to form all these different committees within the committee, you know, like a marketing committee, a fundraising committee, whatever it is. You don't need them yet. Just start off with a committee and start getting people that you feel would benefit the community in there. Remember those, the guys who are best with a pack on their back and a gun in their hands, keep them in the militia. Those that are more civic and publicly minded, or those who are just physically, just can't handle the beating of humping a pack all day anymore. Let those guys do better work somewhere else.
Yeah, but the guys,
if they're not a trainer in the militia, then have them join a committee. Have them form that committee.
And the militia,
you don't want to give up a master sergeant that's an incredible trainer to you guys, a former master sergeant who's an incredible trainer. You want to keep them in the militia. Yeah, I got that. But other people, get them into the committee. Sorry, Gary, what was that?
The committee of the whole, or a militia committee would be the ones that would review applicants, decide who was going to be commissioned, and then issue a written commission, making them an officer without pay or $1 a year or whatever the pay might be based on your abilities. But they would be the civil authority, either Committee of Safety or the Militia Committee, would be the civil authority that granted those commissions. If they chose to let a company, once a guy enlisted a company, they would elect him their leader because he brought them together, then the commission would go to him. If people just came to the committee and volunteered, you break them up into companies and then have them look at their work together for a couple of weeks and decide who they're comfortable with as the leader, and then those are commissioned. But the Committee of Safety is the one that has to issue the commission by whatever means they use to make the determination. And commissions, you don't make generals over 10 men. You don't make colonels over 10. You don't make majors over 10 men. Realistically, 10 men would be a second lieutenant. A company would be a captain. A battalion would be a major. So there has to be some realistic assignment of rank with regard to the commissions as well.
Well, we're down to our last 60 seconds. So in closing, we've got some great shows coming up again in the upcoming week. I've got an individual coming in on the next Militia Monday show. His name is Joseph Martino. He wrote a book called Resisting Tyranny. He's a retired colonel. He was also a researcher for the government as well, a scientist as well, I believe. So he wrote a book called Resisting Tyranny, a really good book, and we'll be having him on Monday. Sunday we're going to be discussing Patriot mythology, surviving Patriot mythology. I'm tired of the mythologies that are going around out there. You know, like Gary was able to debunk one of those Patriot mythologies. So we'll be discussing, you know, how to survive Patriot mythology and how to get around it and how to really find out if it is true or not. And then Tuesday again we'll have part three of this show.
Avoid the distractions created by the Patriot mythology.
Avoid the distractions created. If it doesn't benefit, if it doesn't advance what we're doing, get out of it and leave it behind. So with that, everybody, take care. You have a great night. And we will see you again on Sunday. Bye-bye.